Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's estimated that more than 4 million undocumented immigrant women currently live in the United States. These immigrant workers are especially vulnerable to exploitation with low pay, hazardous work conditions, and, for women, sexual exploitation. The Center for Ethics and Human Values at Ohio State University is sponsoring a year-long series of programs bringing together researchers from many disciplines to address the complex social and moral issues raised by immigration in the 21st century. The Brothel and the Factory is a symposium at the OSU Theater Department focusing on immigration and women's labor and bringing together guest scholars and theater performances. Joining us now is the organizer of the symposium, Anna Elena Puga, assistant professor in the OSU Department of Theater. Professor Puga is the author of several books on Latin American and U.S. Latino theater. She's also the translator of The Matchmaker, a play by Argentinian playwright Patricia Suarez, being performed at OSU this weekend. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Francesca Spedaliari. She is a PhD student in theater at OSU and the director of another play being performed at OSU this weekend, Real Women Have Curves, by American playwright Josefina Lopez. Welcome to the show, Francesca.
Thank you.
We'll post a link for more information about the symposium and the performances at our website, wosu.org/allsides. So, Anna, the title of the symposium, The Brothel and the Factory, Staging Immigration and Women's Labor, may be a surprising take on women immigrants and labor, but as you write in your book, Spectacular Bodies, Dangerous Borders, the international trade in sex trafficking is not a recent phenomenon.
Yes, this play, Matchmaker, is actually set in Argentina in the early 20th century. And Argentina, like the United States, is a country of immigrants. And this play is about how women from poor villages in Eastern Europe were, under false pretenses, convinced by supposedly eligible bachelors to travel to Argentina.
And the exact same thing is going on today.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going on all around the world in different ways,
right,
in different places.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. The play is loosely based on historical facts of a forced prostitution trade of Eastern European women to Latin America.
Yes. There was an organization called Zui Migdal, which the play features. One of the characters is a member of this organization. And he is a pimp posing as an eligible bachelor.
So what happens in the play?
Well, I don't want to give away
the
whole story because many people might want to come and see it. And one of the things that I find really delightful about the play is how many surprises it has and so many unexpected turns. But it takes place in Poland, though it's also very much about Argentina. And it's about a community and the women within the community who are collaborating, cooperating to try to exert some control over their destinies.
So how does the play provide a different perspective on the sex trade as a form of women's labor, particularly as it applies to immigrants?
Well, I think one of the things that the play does is that it doesn't morally stigmatize sex work. It looks at women who are doing the best they can under very difficult circumstances. And without being melodramatic or sentimental, it's very empathetic towards those women. And it looks at sex work as just another kind of forced labor, which is a situation that a lot of immigrants all over the world get into, especially undocumented immigrants today.
Francesca, you're directing Real Women Have Curves, the second play, which is being performed beginning tonight as a double bill with The Matchmaker.
Yes.
There was a successful 2002 film version of Real Women Have Curves starring the actress, well-known actress, America Ferrera. How does the play differ from the film?
Well, in the movie, there is a focus also on the men in the life of Anna, who is the protagonist. And the play is just the women working in this teeny sewing factory in East L.A. So there is a very, very strong spotlight on the women and their relationship.
The main characters of the play are Anna, a young Latina woman who wants to go to college, and her older sister, Estella, who owns the sewing factory where they work. What pressures do Estella and the factory workers face?
Well, Estella is preparing those dresses that are for very thin women that would then be given to a bigger distributor, and they sell them for $13 while the distributor gives them to big department stores for $200. So there is this kind of exploitation going on. But she's also an undocumented worker, and while the rest of her family actually, after the amnesty in the mid-1980s, has actually managed to get green cards to stay legally in the United States. She hasn't because she owns some money, and so she's being brought to court for a lawsuit. So there is that, you know, there's that little thing that happens over there with being part of a family while you are the only person that doesn't have the documents to stay legally in the country. Anna is a very bright young woman. She wants to go to college, but she does not have the money for it. So she's striving to figure out what to do with her future. And on top of everything else, there's weight issues, image issues, and the dynamics between the two girls and the mother.
The author of the play, the playwright, was only 19 years old when she wrote it. I thought that was very interesting, and so much in the play echoes her own experience. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yes. Well, Josefina Lopez, she actually was in a situation that was very similar to the one that Anna is in. She was undocumented for part of her life, and she actually did work in a sewing factory. So she experienced a lot of the things that Anna talks about, the fear of the raids from immigration and people being deported. And she also had image issues. So the fact that she was a woman with curves and how that comes into a society that pressures a lot of women and a lot of Latinas in this case to look at themselves, if they have some curves, as not desirable in a way. So yeah, so I think that's where Josefina put herself into the play.
Anna in the book, I mean in the play, wants to go to college, and the other characters in the play, or at least some of them, discourage her, saying, why do you want to do that? You won't be attractive to men.
Yes. Yes, that is true. There's cultural pressure in the sense of a woman should be a mother and should be at home taking care of the children and finding somehow bettering yourself for going to university is still looked upon as a strange thing.
You know, we were talking earlier about the body image issues. And I was wondering, is it the same body image issue that all women are facing and have been for a long time, or is it different for Latinas?
Well, in a way, it is the same, but when it comes to Latinas, I think skin color also plays a big part in it. There is the fairer you are, the more beautiful and attractive you are. So it is a common ground that all women share, but there's also that layer that it's added on top.
There's also that conflict that pops up in a lot of different ways, and that is women are our own worst enemies.
Yes, in a way it's true. I mean, the mother is this, we could think it as the antagonist of the play, but it's more evident in the movie. In the play it's mm-hmm. much less, but she is the one that keeps calling Anna fat and reminding Estella that she's unmarried, that she would like to have grandchildren. So in a way I do think that that's true.
614-292-8513 if you would like to join the conversation. We are talking about, well, we're inspired. The conversation today is inspired by the Center for Ethics and Human Values at Ohio State University. It's sponsoring a year-long series of programs on the issue of and the issues raised by immigration in the 21st century. We've been talking with Ana Elena Puga. She's an assistant professor in the OSU Department of Theater, and also most recently, Francesca Spadagliari. She is a PhD student in theater at OSU. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's another subtle issue, I think. The women are making dresses that they can't afford. There's the economic conflict.
Yes, there is that conflict. I mean, as I said, you know, selling, making those dresses and selling them to a bigger distributor for $13, who then sells them to big department stores like, you know, Bloomingdale's. That's the one they cite in the play for $200. That is a really big conflict. Anna keeps talking about, you know, minimum wage and the fact that her sister cannot even pay her that much because she says she's not fast enough ironing, but it's really because if you're only getting paid $13 for a dress that requires a lot of work, how is that money getting distributed?
We opened up at the top of the hour with a cut from the film, and it's Anna talking to her sister Estella. And it may not be echoed in the play, I'm not sure, but Anna says, you expect me to do this dirty work for nothing. And Estella says, this is dirty work. And Anna responds, this is a sweatshop. Don't you get it? And that raises a question about sometimes people don't even realize where they're at.
Yes, I think in the movie it's much more explicit than in the play. There is this ongoing, I guess, conflict based on money between Anna and Estella in the play, but in the movie is made very, very clear and explicit. In the play, there's references to, you know, Anna gets paid less than all of the other workers, and Estella justifies it as being reporting for taxes, which she doesn't do. There's references to McDonald's and, you know, being paid $3.35 an hour that was still, it's about the same that she gets paid once she moves to the shop and works for her sister. So there are those economics undertone. There's also a very vocal response that happens when Estella announces the fact that the dresses are sold for $200, but it's not nearly as explicit as in the movie.
Another little thing, there's so many little ideas. The main character, Anna, is proud of her ambition to go to college, but at first she feels superior.
Yes.
And she learns something about that.
She does. I mean, in her final monologue, she realizes that, you know, she came into the shop thinking that she would teach those women about women's liberation and sexual liberation, but then she realizes that in a way those women are also struggling and trying to make the best they can with what they have. So there is a mutual learning that happens that she only really truly grasps at the end of it all. So she acknowledges her origins and what she has learned in the factory when she leaves to go to university.
We are going to continue our conversation to the tune of the year-long series of programs put forth by the Center for Ethics and Human Values at Ohio State University regarding the complex social and moral issues raised by immigration in the 21st century. We welcome your conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and it's a story 200 years in the making. Brought to life by Ballet Met, the CJO, and WOSU. Jazz Moves Columbus, the story of our city through kicks, turns, and trumpet blasts. It's February 2nd through the 12th. Tickets, visit balletmet.org.
Chase supports equality programming on WOSU Public Media and is proud to support the Columbus Neighborhoods Project. It's the story of determined pioneers, devastating floods, a vision for a state capital, flourishing theaters, churches, and businesses. A look at what life's like today for people moving back downtown and for families who've been in Franklinton for five generations. Learn more when WOSU-TV presents Columbus Neighborhoods, Downtown Franklinton, airing Tuesday, February 14th at 8 p.m. only on WOSU-TV.
Mostly sunny skies today, a high near 50 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 30. More sunshine and a high of 52 for Friday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about the challenges faced by immigrant women in the United States. If you have a story to tell, share it with us, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can tweet us at Ann Fisher, WOSU, hashtag immigrant. Still with us is Anna Elena Puga. She is assistant professor in the OSU Department of Theater with a joint appointment to the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. She organized a symposium on immigration and women's labor at the theater department and translated The Matchmaker. It's a play being performed at the symposium. And by the way, the symposium also is co-sponsored by the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. Anna, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And also still with us is Francesca Spedalieri. She is a PhD student in theater at OSU and the director of the second play being performed at OSU this weekend, Real Women Have Curves. Once again, Francesca, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Joining us now is Sandra Lopez. She is the co-founder of Latinas in Ohio, a group organized to develop a network of support for Latinas of different backgrounds in Ohio. Sandra was born and raised in the Dominican Republic and has been a resident of Ohio since 1996. She currently works for the Ohio Department of Public Safety as a quality auditor for the Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles, Ohio BMV, as we know it here. Welcome back to the show, Sandra.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
Sandra, the goal of Latinas in Ohio is to foster conversations among Latinas of different backgrounds. Is it working?
Yes. What we find is that for a lot of the women that come to Ohio, they don't necessarily have a networking opportunity as maybe other professionals do. And we offer a space for women to come together. And we don't judge, you know, you don't have to be the president of the company or have a title, just any woman, any Latina, or if you feel Latina. Sometimes we get students just from different colleges that want to be immersed in the culture and be part of it, also joining because they like the experience. Maybe they lived in Latin America and want to have access to the group here in Ohio.
Their common denominator is they speak the same language, but do they always speak the same language?
Yes and no. When people think about Spanish, there's a lot of different accents, a lot of different words.
And different life experience.
And different life experiences. I think the common language is the need of sharing with people who maybe miss food or culture or music or family. And there is that longing that whether you came from Mexico or the Dominican Republic, you feel the same way. You remember growing up watching a certain show, you get a joke. So sometimes we say that arroz con leche is not the same as rice pudding. It is basically the same, but when you call it arroz con leche, it just has like that extra flavor. So that's what we're here. That's what we try to do. That's the experience.
Do you ever hear, I just have to ask, that people say it's a lot better than it used to be in Central Ohio when it comes to the food?
Oh, my God. It's funny because we just had this conversation last night with a group of friends, and it's like we have like five Dominican grocery stores now. And my brother lives in L.A., and I sent Dominican food from Columbus to LA to my brother. So yes, I've been here 15 years. It's come a long
way. Yeah, 15 years then. It's definitely come a long way even in 15 years. Do the issues raised by the plays we've been talking about being performed at Ohio State sound familiar? Do present-day Latinas face some of the same challenges?
Absolutely. And I think as new Latinas come to Ohio, not only directly from Latin America, but also from other parts of the United States, they see that there is a challenge in fitting in the workplace, in not losing your identity, but also being able to do the work just as everyone else. I know that for me, when I first came here, I already had a college degree and spoke what I thought was really good English. And I had to start at the bottom also. And I used to work landscape because I like plants. So people immediately assume that you're just another Latino person working landscaping. But I had a four-year college degree and was considered myself very smart. And people talked to me
like you were, they were
a day laborer, mm-hmm. basically. So you have to remember that that's not who you are. And because someone puts you in a certain box, it doesn't necessarily define you. And you can also teach them. I think some people just don't know better. They haven't been exposed. My ex-husband used to teach Spanish at a little school outside Columbus. And the first time I went to the school, I made Dominican food and had for the Spanish classes. I made it to the local newspaper because it was the first time they had like rice and beans. So part of our job, I feel, is also sharing with people, giving them the opportunity to experience the culture. And I think when you get to know anyone, Somali, Chinese, Asian American, you find that there is so much in common, that you love your family, that you care for your children, that you want things to be better. And it doesn't matter where you come from, that's equal to any human being.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I've just been talking with Sandra Lopez, co-founder of Latinas in Ohio. We're talking about the women's immigration experience right now. Give us a call if you have something to add, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Anna, the double bill of the two plays about immigration, The Matchmaker, and also Real Women Have Curves, begins tonight, and the symposium, The Brothel and the Factory, Staging Immigration and Women's Labor, begins tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We're going to post a link about more information about the symposium and the performances at our website at wosu.org/allsides. What is the takeaway you hope to accomplish with this symposium?
The takeaway. Well, I mean, I think one of the great things about the symposium is the discussion of labor and how all labor has dignity, but also some kinds of labor is not rewarded well, particularly working class people, day laborers, sex workers, factory workers of all different types, domestic laborers. And we have an impressive group of guests who are going to be coming to the symposium. Among these, Mary Romero, the author of a book, The Maid's Daughter. Mary Romero is a very distinguished sociologist, and she wrote this book based on 20 years of interviews with different women who worked in domestic labor. And focused on one woman, Olivia, who grew up in the servants' quarters of a very wealthy family's home. And the wealthy patron started to kind of take over the life of Olivia's daughter and sent her to a fancy school, but then also they would go to the school, not the biological mother. So I think there are all sorts of issues that are raised about you know, how we treat people in society, both in terms of respect, as we were just saying, but also in terms of earning a living wage. And, you know, whether you're a day laborer or a sex worker, you deserve to earn a living wage and you deserve to be treated with respect.
The storyline, well, for one thing, it reminds me of The Help, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But The Maid's Daughter, it's an interesting, subtle point there. It's as if they're not treating her as a whole person. She's their maid. She can't also be a mother.
Mm-hmm. Or she can't, the daughter can go to a fancy school, but for whatever reason, the mother is not welcome in that space.
Mm-hmm. Separating her and categorizing her and pigeonholing her.
Yeah, and diminishing her.
Right, in the process.
Way. Right, because maybe she's embarrassing or she doesn't speak English well or, you know, in their view.
Smith, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I was rather interested in the comment that was made relative to color of skin, and it just kind of struck me rather odd that in the spring of the year, so many white women, pale white women, go out, and guys too, to get a suntan at the expense of catching melanoma, which is, I understand, the greatest, what, the highest death rate among the Caucasians?
Yeah, I don't do that, but go on.
I know you might not do that. But
you're right. Well, yeah, to a lesser extent, but the point is, people want that glow from the sun. The point is,
people want to have some color. And the little lady said, the lighter you are, the more attractive you are. Well, that's not necessarily true all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Smith.
Okay.
The skin color issue pops up a lot in a lot of different contexts.
I couldn't hear what he said.
Oh,
so.
Okay. He was talking about how Caucasians go to dangerous lengths to get color. And I think it was Francesca who mentioned the issue about the lightness of skin and that sort of a thing. Do you want to address that, Francesca Spadalieri?
Yeah. Also in talking to not only Latina friends, but also, you know, Indian friends, there is that issue that the lighter and the fairer you are in society, the beautifuler you're considered. Well, in Italy, where I'm from, you do go to the extent of, you know, wanting to get darker and get a tan and have that sun-kissed skin. There is a line in the play when they say, careful, don't stay too close to the window because otherwise they'll see the nopal on your forehead and the immigration will take you away. And the nopal, it's, you know, something that you get on your face when you are in the sun a lot. So it's that, you know, what we could consider this beautiful suntan skin, but then in this context is not, it's considered a mark of race and ethnicity.
It's interesting. Uh-huh. Race comes up as an issue also in Matchmaker in that, and you wouldn't necessarily think that it would, but the pimp posing as a suitor tells the Matchmaker character, you know, I want a woman who's blonde and fair-skinned because in Argentina they prefer blondes. And this has to do with the whole history of racism in Argentina and wanting an ethnically cleansed kind of population from Northern Europe, when, in fact, most of the immigrants to Argentina ended up coming from Spain and Italy. But this was always the racist kind of ideal of nation building.
Thanks, Smith, for that call. We appreciate it. 614-292-8513. We have a few minutes left. Sandra, you were appointed by the Director of Public Safety to represent the department at the Ohio Council on Women and Girls. What is the purpose of the council and what's been accomplished so far?
Well, the council had actually been put on hold since the new administration. But part of the work that it's being done, and there's a group of women that still get together, is to review policies and the impact that it will have specifically on women and girls across the different agencies of the state. And part of the result of the work that we had been doing that we found is that child care is essential to the progress of women in the state of Ohio. And we are trying to propose some changes and requests for funding on helping women to provide for child care. It's stressful for a lot of families. It's costly, and sometimes it makes the difference for a woman to go back to school and who's going to take care of my children. I know I don't have children myself, but in Latino families, because we're big on our extended family. Our family is the extended family and beyond. You can always reach out to mom or abuelita, the grandmother, the godmother, the uncles, and you have that really big network of people that will support you. But for the average American family here in the state of Ohio, that is not true. So we try to review policies as they in laws as they become available and start going through the house and just see how they will impact women and girls.
Anna Puga, could you give us some other examples of some of the folks that are going to be at the symposium?
Sure. Isabel Molina Guzman, who's an associate professor of media and cinema studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She wrote a great book called Dangerous Curves about images of Latina women in the media. And then we're going to have a couple of panels with graduate students tomorrow, or rather Saturday, February 4th in the Thompson Library on campus. And those events are all free and open to the public. And then also we're going to have another faculty panel with Paola Hernandez, who's an associate professor from the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Mae Farnsworth, who is an expert on feminist theater in the early 20th century in Argentina. So she's going to be talking about Matchmaker, as it relates to other feminist plays that were written around the time in which Matchmaker is set. Because Matchmaker was written in just 2001, but it's set in 1920.
Bringing that up, is there any sense about what the immigration experience is for women in other countries and how it is alike or different than what it is in the United States? And what lessons we can take from those?
Well, I think one of the things that's really interesting about Matchmaker is that it's been staged in other countries in Latin America, for instance, in Bolivia, as an allegory of what's happening to Bolivian women when they go from Bolivia, which is a poorer country, to wealthier countries such as Argentina or Mexico, for example. And they go through a lot of the similar situation that they experience a lot of similar things to what women from Latin America coming to the United States experience in terms of potential mistreatment, abuse, being paid badly, being treated as kind of a cheap, disposable form of labor, where people are very eager to get their services, but they're not necessarily eager to provide the services that keep them well and healthy and able to support their families in a dignified way.
We are out of time right now. I just want to thank my guests, Ana Elena Puga, assistant professor at the OSU Department of Theater and also the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. And Sandra Lopez, co-founder of Latinas in Ohio. Sandra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anne.
Anna, thanks for joining us. And Francesca Spadalieri, PhD student and director at the OSU Theater Department. Nice to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. When we coming back, we're going to get a little bit of a preview of on the bicentennial for the city of Columbus and the celebrations ahead. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the producers of Smash, the new NBC backstage musical drama about the people putting together a Broadway musical. We'll hear from Neil Marin and Craig Zaden. Join us.
The past fades away.
Because as of this day, Norma Jean's gone.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media will host Chefs in the City Thursday, May 3rd from 5:30 until 10 p.m. at WOSU at COSI. Tickets are on sale now. Celebrity chef Hubert Keller and several of Central Ohio's finest chefs will participate in live cooking demonstrations, preparing dishes for audience members to enjoy. The event will also feature a cookbook signing, a silent auction, and will be taped for TV. A limited number of tickets are on sale now. Visit WOSU.org/chefs for more information and for tickets. And 40 degrees with some clouds in downtown Columbus. Some sunshine later today and a high near 50 degrees. Clear skies for tonight and a low of 30. More sunshine, another nice day for Friday with a high of 52. Expect a little bit of rain Friday night, a low of 35 degrees. And then a slight chance of rain for Saturday and a high of 45 degrees to start the weekend. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Just a little jazz to get us in the mood for our conversation coming up. We're going to talk about Jazz Moves Columbus. I'll tell you more about that in a sec. Last night, WOSU premiered its newest documentary in a series about the neighborhoods of Columbus, Columbus Neighborhoods, Downtown Franklinton. It airs February 14th at 8 p.m. on WOSU-TV. The premiere last night was the first of a series of events planned for the year to celebrate the 200th birthday, the bicentennial of the city of Columbus. We'll be talking more about all of that throughout the year, of course, but we thought it was a good time to get a primer from Jamie Green, the program manager for the Columbus Bicentennial. For all the news on the celebration, go to 200columbus.com. That's 200columbus.com. Welcome back to the show, Jamie.
Thank you, Ann.
Hard to believe it was a year ago that you first came here, and it was like kind of a preview.
Yeah, it is really hard to believe.
It's flown by.
Yes.
Also with us is Gerard Charles. He's artistic director of Ballet Met, which with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra will present Jazz Moves Columbus opening tonight at the Rife Center's Capitol Theater. For tickets, go to Ticketmaster.com. Welcome to the show, Gerard.
Good morning, Ken.
So Ballet Met and Columbus Jazz and the Columbus Jazz Orchestra have collaborated before.
Yes.
In 2006 and 2009. Why did it make sense to do that again in celebration of the bicentennial?
Well, you know, I think this bicentennial thing has been a wonderful thing for the city because this city has got so much to offer. And I just think it's amazing how people can coalesce around this. I mean, it's a great opportunity to start bragging about what we've got here. And Ballet Met and the Columbus Jazz Orchestra are both born in this city. They bring really talented professionals here who live in this community. And it seemed a wonderful idea to bring ourselves back together again. They've been fabulous performances in the past, and why not center that around this great celebration of the city and all it's got to offer?
Columbus Jazz Orchestra Artistic Director Byron Stripling picked the music, and six choreographers were enlisted for the dances. So What are some of the stories they tell together?
Well, you know, the main thing is to celebrate the two art forms that our two organizations represent, and also WOSU, because don't forget we have some images from the neighborhood series.
Between the dance segments, right.
Yes. And, you know, so that helps weave together the historical point of it. This is not a time to go to the theater and get a lecture on the history of Columbus. It really is a very celebratory kind of experience. And it does follow a little bit of a timeline. It certainly does pay homage to certain aspects of life in Columbus or times of things that happened here in Columbus. The six choreographers worked with the music that Byron had suggested. Some of them wanted to tweak it a little bit. Some said, I want to do something completely different. In the end, we all got on the same page. And last night was actually the first time we all got together on stage. And it went really, really well. So tonight's opening is going to be terrific, he says, with both everything crossed.
Between dance segments, as you mentioned, WOSU-TV will screen excerpts from its Columbus Neighborhoods series. How did the stories of Columbus actually inspire the choreography, or didn't? You're saying it was a celebratory thing that the choreographers are trying to achieve.
And yes, I think we didn't want to hem-tie, especially we've got choreographers coming in from New York
and
places. They
don't
really know what Columbus's history is all, you know, really tied to it. So it's not a literal, you know, this story is about the founding fathers of the city, and this one is about the riots in the 60s. It's more generic in that kind of way. But it's not just the footage from the neighborhood series. There's actually archival footage and things that we've woven in there. So they've made these videos specially for these performances. And so some of them have played with the jazz orchestra playing music, and there's images like, say, of the flood, and the band plays Motherless Child for that. And it's very fitting marriage there. Other pieces, during the intermission, there's actually, you know, for those of you that stay in your seats during intermission, there's a little bonus for you there. There's going to be a kind of a charming overview of where Columbus was, and there's some great footage of what people 100 years ago thought the city of Columbus was going to look like in 100 years from now, which, of course, is today. And one of their big plans was for us to have a park along the riverfront, and, you know, 100 years later, kind of happened.
614-292-8513. We do have a few minutes if you have a question or comment about something to do with the Bicentennial celebration. Now's the time to ask. Jamie Green, the program manager for the Columbus Bicentennial, is also with us, along with Gerard Charles, artistic director for Ballet Met. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well. Jamie, the arts are just one aspect of the Bicentennial Week, and then throughout the year, you've planned more than 40 events and exhibitions for just the upcoming week. So lots of them are free. How did you decide what to showcase? How did you ever whittle it down?
Well, I think the interesting message about your question is that we didn't whittle down, that we organized the Bicentennial process for the whole year with the idea that it should be a platform, so that if you, an organization or an individual, had something that they really wanted to showcase and share, we've tried to enable that, not tamp it down. So those 40 events, many of them are by the initiative of people that are proud of this community, proud of what they're doing, and want a way to showcase that.
They don't all, as I was looking through them, they don't all necessarily have a literal, theme of Bicentennial to them. They are, again, it's just this is a time to showcase, you're saying.
That's right. One of the ways that I've tried to articulate what the year should be about is really revealing all the good things that we do here and that we should be proud of. And so if it's in the spirit of pride building and engagement, you know, we're all about that. Many of them have found some very literal ways to connect to the Bicentennial, but some of them are not. They're really just the opportunity to showcase, you know, what we do and do well here.
Before I forget, I know the WOSU is also producing a documentary of Jazz Moves Columbus and how it was created and put together. I wanted to let people know that. One of the free events is the 165th birthday party for Clintonville.
Right.
And it makes me wish I still lived there.
Right.
Is this the only concurrent birthday celebration, or are there other things like that? And what's going to happen there?
Well, we've actually, as part of our, you know, and if your listeners want to go to the website that you referenced, there is a year-long graphic calendar. And one of the dimensions of the calendar is not just events, but it's also identifying historic milestones. So we've got a number of organizations that are celebrating things like the 165th, but also some very special ones. You know, A.D. Farrow, the Harley-Davidson dealership, celebrating 100. Phillips Coney Island is 100 this year. I mean, so we are trying to identify those other milestone events, and at some point we're going to find a way to celebrate them all in this process. So if your listeners have ideas and other anniversaries, we want to know about them.
So this is a living calendar then?
Absolutely.
It can be amended.
That's right. We're just, you know, we've got 11, almost 11 months still to go, and we still are open, and we're getting in. The more people are learning about this year and this opportunity, the more we're hearing about it. And so we are open. This is a dynamic process. We've not closed the door on any of those ideas.
One of the – well, tell us about Illuminate Columbus. I looked that up specifically because of what we saw last night.
Right, right.
Tell us about that.
So Illuminate Columbus is that on February 10th, the city's actual birthday is February 14th. But as you alluded to, Ann, the week leading up to it, beginning really next week, the 8th, going through the 14th, we've got these 40 events. Illuminate Columbus is one of those. And that is basically where we've got a lot of business and corporations, building owners who have in the recent years – made investments in lighting their building. So we're actually asking them to coordinate their lighting in that night. You know, the colors are red, white, and blue. So on the night of February 10th, which is the night of the birthday celebration, the big birthday party, of which there are still tickets available for that too, the buildings will light. Nationwide on Tower 1 has agreed to actually put up in writing, you know, 200 Columbus on the side of that building. So there's a number of business owners who've collaborated on using their existing lighting infrastructure to bring to light the city that night.
And last night at COSAI, they unveiled an installation,
right,
a lighting installation. Is that related to it, or is that something that they did independently again?
It's coincidental to that.
Okay.
We actually – that what you saw last night, Anne, and what your listeners can go look at for the next several weeks is part of the Public Art 2012 initiative, which are installations throughout the year that are happening. That was actually the first one, is the lighting of the facade, the east facade of COSAI.
Yeah, the east facade of COSAI from sundown to sunup,
right,
every night. So check that out. It's Stuart Williams is the artist. It's called Breath of Light at COSAI. Speaking of COSAI, they have a Columbus Family Weekend scheduled for next week.
That's right.
That's a biggie.
That's a biggie. One of the things that we've tried to do, and this is not easy, the community is large, it's diverse, but we want to provide things, and I think we've done this in this week, for anybody who cares and wants to engage in this. COSAI was one example of using their assets and their resources to invite families to come in and experience games and traditions of maybe yesteryear. We'll have a glimpse, you know, back into that. COSAI has come up a number of times, and one of the things that is extraordinary for me to observe what's going on is the level of collaboration. You know, Gerard's initiative here with the Jazz Arts Group is just one example. But
right.
The other thing that I think is important about that weekend with COSAI and the family weekend is that is also the opening of the Columbus Historical Society's new home in COSAI. Again, the message is about collaboration and working together, that they could have went off and did something, but together I think they've agreed that they could do something extraordinary together. So your listeners should also be looking for really the first time ever, for Columbus to have a more appropriate setting to share the history in the form of the new exhibits, permanent exhibit space in COSAI.
614-292-8513. There's still a few minutes left with Jamie Green, the program manager for the Columbus Bicentennial, and also Gerard Charles, artistic director for Ballet Met. If you have a question about 200 Columbus, the Bicentennial, give us a call. If you want to go online, you can go to Facebook. They have a Facebook page, 200columbus.com. You can also, it's 200columbus.com if you're interested in that. We'll post it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. There is the big party.
That's right.
The big gala. There's
right.
more tickets available.
Right.
What's going to happen there? When are we going to find out?
When are we going to find out? Well, There's some extraordinary things that are happening, but what we've tried to make this an evening of celebrating what we love about Columbus and really sharing those special people and the special stories. So there's a piece about the voices of Columbus, which is both a live and video tribute of the people that have really helped make Columbus what it is, and those people that have been nurtured by this community to go on and do special items. We have a special anthem that's been written for the birthday party by Milt Ruffin, an extraordinary talent here, principal at Fort Hays High School, but an accomplished musician in his own right. We witnessed the first rehearsal on Sunday night of the Bicentennial Choir, voices from throughout the city who came together, who had never met each other before this night, never heard the song, and Milt, in that evening, transformed them into a collaborative group that is prepared to sing this 200 people strong on the night of the birthday party. We've got special performances of Shadowbox Theater that night. We have an extraordinary display of our talent from Columbus State Community College, where the pastry department there, those students are...
Ooh, yay.
They are baking the birthday cakes, the icons of Columbus. There'll be 250 lineal feet of birthday cakes here that, you know, the Ohio Theater... or the Levesque. I mean, these are, you know, three-dimensional illustrations of the talent of young people that are residing here in our community. So it'll be a very festive celebration of who we are.
And there's tickets still available.
There are tickets still available right off of our website.
Okay, and there's tickets still available to...
There are some
Jasmine's
tickets
Columbus.
Still available to Columbus, but they are selling fast. So I really do... I mean, it's not just a line. They are going great, yeah. Which is great. And there's also another little mini tie-in there. Both Byron Stripling and myself are celebrating 10 years as artistic directors of our relative organization. So,
well, happy birthday, lucky us.
Thank you.
I don't know if I should, but if you're a WOSU member card card holder, if you're a member of WOSU, you can get your tickets for Jazz Moves Columbus 2-for-1. So,
what a deal.
Yet another reason to be proud of showing your support for WOSU. What you said, Gerard, that you've got your fingers crossed and your toes crossed. Mm-hmm. But what does it feel like to do something like this? Is so commemorative, so iconic for the city.
There's a lot of focus on this program, and so that's probably true of a lot of the programs we do. But for this particular one, I think there's a great deal of excitement, a great deal of anticipation for it. And so you put all your best efforts into it, and then as an artistic director, you just have to sort of like let it go. It's like your children. They go out into the world, and they make what they will of it. So this has been a great process to get to this place. It's been a lot of hard work, a lot of little stressful moments. But now it's going to go live on its own, and it's kind of exciting to look forward to seeing that. I can't wait for the audience to see it. We've had a couple of open rehearsals, and that spontaneous positive response that the people who were watching those rehearsals had made you know, like, yeah, we're on the right track here.
Yeah, the applause and stuff, it matters, doesn't it?
Absolutely does.
I just want to remind folks, now, the actual birthday for the city is February 14th.
That's right.
So that happened before Hallmark made it Valentine's Day.
Yep.
Right?
Right. And we think that's completely appropriate because so much of this is about loving Columbus, right? Being proud. So a lot of love on the 14th.
And when you get home from your Valentine's dinner at 8 p.m., WOSU-TV will air its newest segment in the documentary series about the neighborhoods of Columbus, Columbus Neighborhoods, Downtown Franklin. So don't forget about that. Jamie Green, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I really appreciate it.
And also Gerard Charles, Artistic Director for Ballet Met.
Thank you very much, Jan.
And again, for everybody, I want to let you know that you can go to WOSU.org and learn more about or get the links for everything we've been talking about today. But if you'd like to, you can go to Facebook, 200columbus.com, or you can go to 200columbus.com on the web and check out everything that's going on. There's 40 different events going on over the next week. Many of them are free. Find out what the COSI, big celebration at COSI with the Columbus Historical Society. I remember the first time I tried to find them and thought, where are they?
Right.
They weren't anywhere.
Right.
Now they are. Also, want to say thanks to the All Sides staff, including my producer, Linda Taylor, associate producer, Amy Jurovich, my All Sides intern, Corinne Gleckler, also All Sides production assistant, Ayan Sheik, and my All Sides High School student intern, Ben Faith. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News, and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.